Okay, good afternoon. My name is Kevin Featherstone, and I'm the head of the European Institute here at the school. This series of lectures on Brexit is co-organized by the European Institute and the Department of Government at the LSE, and particularly by Tony Travers and myself. It is a series that's open to all members of the LSE academic community, staff and students across all departments. And as you can see, the series is scheduled for each Wednesday of this Lent term in this lecture theatre at the same time each week. Can I also point out that after the individual lectures have taken place, we will be uploading the film and recordings of the lectures. So you can see there are a couple of cameras, so you'll subsequently be able to download the lectures and absorb them more fully. The series is covering many different aspects of Brexit. It follows a series in the Michaelmas term before Christmas, dealing with foreign policy matters. This term, we're focusing very much on the domestic British and the European Union implications of Brexit. We're covering different disciplines: law, political science, economics, political sociology, etc., etc. And the schedule for the lectures covers all of those major issues that are currently being discussed in the media, both here and abroad. We meet today, of course, after the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, made her speech yesterday outlining how she sees the future of Brexit and defining the outcome that she would wish to have. Of course, between now and then, there are many questions to be answered, many implications to be considered, and indeed so much uncertainty to be tackled. So I'm delighted today that we can focus on the constitutional, the legal aspects of Brexit, what might be negotiated, what might be the implications of the eventual deal. And I'm delighted that two colleagues from the Law Department, who I think will be well known to a number of you, but perhaps not all, Joe Merkins, who's a specialist on English and European constitutional law, and Floris de Ritter, a specialist on EU law and political theory, questions of free movements, the euro crisis, the response to those issues. I'm going to pass over to our two speakers. They will allow plenty of time for questions and answers after they've finished, and at the very end, I'll come back and say a word of thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin, and good afternoon to everyone who's here. Thank you for coming. If you ask me, which you haven't, but if you did ask me, I would say that the consequences of the EU referendum last June are almost entirely domestic. So I think that the title, the constitutional aftershock or aftershocks, is entirely apt. I think that, of course, there are consequences for the European Union, but actually I think that they pale in comparison to what the United Kingdom will have to go through. The United Kingdom is, of course, perfectly capable of changing its constitution. It is perfectly capable of dealing with a momentous decision to leave the European Union. Now, in the past, when I was a student, I learned that there would be something like a Royal Commission, or at the very least, a white paper to put into plan, an idea, to publish a plan of how to bring major constitutional change about. I think that what we are seeing today is an attempt by the government to micromanage Brexit, to avoid consultations, to avoid parliamentary involvement, and I think that that will backfire. We see it backfire in relation to this whole Article 50 and Brexit issue, and I will talk for 10 minutes about that. But I think we also see it backfire, ironically, when The government does want to involve the Westminster Parliament, and that would be in relation to Scotland and Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, so in relation to those regions that have had devolved administrations and parliaments for the past 20 years. Let me just quickly ask, a couple of faces are familiar, but is anyone here not familiar with UK constitutional law? Everyone is familiar with UK constitution. Okay, so a number of people aren't, and the rest are lying, so you're in good company. So there are basically, and for those that have already heard this, my apologies, but repetition is never harmful in public law. I know that from experience. So basically, there are two legal sources that the United Kingdom Constitution recognises. One is an Act of Parliament, the other one is the common law. Those are the two recognised sources of law. There are, for historical reasons, or there is for historical reasons, also this third source called prerogative powers, and its origins go back to royal absolutism, when the king was able to rule by fiat using the royal prerogative in order to make or amend legislation. Since 1688-89, the use of the prerogative power by the king, or now by ministers exercising the power on behalf of the crown, has been heavily curtailed by statute and by judges. And it's been curtailed because, if you think about it, the prerogative powers, I don't know why there's feedback on here, but the prerogative powers are a source that allow a government minister to exercise political authority but bypassing Parliament. So the definition of a prerogative power is that it allows for the exercise of political power without parliamentary consent. Now, there are examples where that is uncontroversial. The issuing of passports, for instance, no one really cares about that. But there are also examples where it is deeply controversial. The deployment of troops, for example, is technically a prerogative power, and parliamentary consent is not needed, although as a matter of political practice, in the last two instances, so 2003 and 2013, parliamentary consent was in fact obtained or denied, was sought and then obtained and denied, but that is as a matter of political practice rather than constitutional necessity. So when it comes to the question of triggering Article 50, the government in its wisdom said that it had a prerogative power, an extra parliamentary, an extra legal power to trigger Article 50. Now, if the effects of triggering Article 50 were only felt in the international domain, in international law, international relations, or diplomacy, then the government would have had a point, and I think it would have won the case last November, December, in the Divisional Court. But the minute it accepted that a category of individual rights would irretrievably and inevitably be lost, the government lost the case. And that category of rights, maybe for some people a trivial right, but it's a political right nonetheless, the right to vote in and stand for European parliamentary elections. Those are rights that the UK government could not under any circumstances guarantee after leaving the EU. Those rights would be lost. They are currently, UK citizens currently have them, but they would irretrievably be lost. And when the government conceded that, when the government's lawyers conceded that, which they had to, they lost the case. They lost the case because it was structured in that way. They accepted the argument and therefore they had to make a concession, and therefore the entire House of Cards collapsed. The case in the Divisional Court involved the famous businesswoman and the not-so-famous hairdresser. The appeal case in the UK Supreme Court, which the rumour is that we'll hear the decision next week, involves those two and a group of others. It involves expats. It involves, we heard about the rights of women and the rights of children, and we heard very strong submissions from Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. So while the government has narrowly stuck to its prerogative power Article 50 line, the case for the other side has expanded from the right to vote in European parliamentary elections to a whole host of other rights, including the constitutional position of Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland under the devolution agreement, which I'll talk about in just a minute. My point goes back to the one about micromanagement. If I was the Prime Minister, I would like to maintain control of this story as well. Theresa May's version of keeping control was to say, let's not consult Parliament and stick to the prerogative power. But she made a mistake. If she'd said, let's keep it in-house by giving Parliament a vote, whether or not to trigger Article 50, she would have kept the courts out, because the courts would not have been able to challenge that decision. It would have been a political question for Parliament to decide that the courts are not institutionally competent to challenge. The minute she goes for a prerogative power to challenge Article 50, then the courts, and they've been doing this for the past 400 years, the courts have claimed for themselves the power to review this constitutional oddity, this extra-legal prerogative power, precisely because it does not fit so well with a constitutional system that is based on the rule of law, which means that it requires that all political authority be backed by law. And in this country, this means an act of parliament. So here, the government is essentially claiming a power to would like to exercise political power not backed by an act of parliament. And that's when the courts step in, which is what they've done consistently for 400 years, and said, no, you can't do that. So there was no... That's why a lot of people said that the Miller decision was actually quite a conservative judgment. It was. It was in tune with consistent constitutional practice and case law of the past 400 years. Not so much constitutional practice. The government once in a political generation comes before court and claims a political power under the prerogative, which it turns out it didn't actually ever have, and so it loses that particular argument. And I think for the reasons that I've explained, I can't predict the future, obviously, but I think that the case will be decided in a very similar way by the UK Supreme Court. So I think the attempt to micromanage Brexit has failed spectacularly for two reasons. First of all, Parliament will be brought in, and now Theresa May yesterday has already said that Parliament will give them a vote on the final deal, which is a much bigger deal for Parliament to vote on than triggering Article 50. And secondly, the micromanagement has failed because she's brought in the courts. Why would you want to do that? Right? Keep the courts out by going straight to Parliament, which is much easier to control if you have a majority and can control your backbenchers, much easier to control than 10 wise men and one wise woman in the UK Supreme Court. It's out of the government's hands. Interestingly, and ironically, the other area where the government is very generous when it comes to involving Westminster Parliament, overly generous, one might say, is Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. Both David Cameron and Theresa May are on record as saying that they want a national consensus when it comes to Brexit. They want Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland to join the negotiating table, and they want them to be involved as much as possible. However, both are also on record as saying that neither Scotland, Wales, nor Northern Ireland will have a veto when it comes to accepting the deal. So let's make sense of this. Let's try and make sense of this, because it doesn't make sense. You can't say you have a space at the negotiating table, but you don't get to say no. Yeah, the United Kingdom doesn't want to be a supplicant to the EU. Well, the Scots, the Northern Irish, and the Welsh aren't either. They're not agents of Theresa May. They are autonomous regions. They have autonomous governments, and they have parliaments that cannot be controlled from Westminster. But I hear you say, isn't the Westminster Parliament sovereign? isn't European Union law a reserved matter under the devolution legislation from 1998? Yes, you're right. Westminster is technically sovereign and could take the United Kingdom out of the EU against the wishes of Scotland and Northern Ireland. Perfectly possible. And European Union law is a reserved matter that does not fall within the powers of the devolved legislations. Problematically, though, both the Government of Wales Act, the Northern Ireland Act, and the Scotland Act say that the Scottish administration, that the devolved governments and devolved parliaments are bound by European Union law. In other words, they are not competent to pass legislation that violates EU law, nor is the government, nor are the local governments, able to make decisions that undermine EU law. And since Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland have primary lawmaking powers at all levels, right, except for the reserve matter, pulling the EU rug from underneath a devolution settlement deeply affects, structurally affects, the way the government implements law and Parliament in the devolved administration makes law. So on the one hand, it's a reserved matter. On the other hand, it affects the operation of the local parliaments and of the regional parliaments and governments. So there's a bit of a conflict there. That needs to be addressed. Now, Theresa May, in her speech yesterday, mentioned Scotland twice, and she mentioned Northern Ireland twice in a speech that lasted, 45 minutes. So I think it is odd that Scotland and Northern Ireland are mentioned merely as an afterthought when the issues, when the Brexit issues, and as they apply in Scotland and Northern Ireland, are actually fundamental and need to be resolved. I don't know if you will be talking about Northern Ireland and Ireland and the border. So, as you know, there is currently an invisible border between Ireland and Northern Ireland. That invisible border is the result of the peace process of the mid-1990s. So you don't notice it. I mean, the currency changes. I think the speed limit changes or something like that. But that's about it. People live in one part of Ireland and work in the other, and there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, and families and friends intermarry and mingle and marry, and it's you don't notice the border, but it's there. If Northern Ireland leaves the EU as part of the UK, then that invisible border will have to become visible. Now, Theresa May talks of a common travel area, yes, which predated the peace agreement. That's fine. The common travel area works for people. It works less well for goods. And it also doesn't work if you imagine, doesn't work for people, if you imagine a European national landing in Dublin and then making their way to the United Kingdom, so immigration through the Irish back door. If you're concerned about immigration, at some point you need to have a border. If it's not between Northern Ireland and Ireland, then it might be, you might just shift it northeastwards and have it between Northern Ireland and the United Kingdom. In effect, it would be saying that Northern Ireland and Ireland reunite in some shape or form, and the actual border becomes between Ireland and the United Kingdom. Now, that's fine. A lot of people would be very content with that situation. It just happens to overturn 800 years of British foreign policy towards Northern Ireland, and it was emphatically not what people had in mind when they voted to leave in the June referendum. So I think it's also criminally reckless to think of Northern Ireland as an afterthought when, given the history, given the troubled relationship Westminster has had with that part of the world. Given its history, I think Northern Ireland is the weakest link, and the entire Brexit negotiation, in my opinion, should be conducted from the position of the weakest link, and that is Northern Ireland. The second weakest link is Scotland. I don't want to talk about the economics of independence. We don't know. One minute the oil price is crashing, now it's on the rise again. Pretty soon it'll run out. I don't think that's the central question. I think the important question is also not what the Westminster Parliament can do. I think the important question is what it should do. Should Westminster be legislating for Scotland without the consent of the Scottish people or the Scottish Parliament? I think the answer to that has to be no. There is no better way to aggravate already irritated and irritable Scottish nationalists than by remotely controlling Scotland. The independence referendum, yes, 2 years ago was lost, but it was narrowly lost. And shortly afterwards, the opinion polls were suggesting that it could be won. Right now, it doesn't look like it could be won. But don't underestimate the anti-English sentiment that you can use and generate to build a case for independence. We have to see. Maybe the Scots will say, oh, actually, Brexit isn't so bad, and they'll happily leave or whatever. We don't know that yet. We need to, I think, wait the next 2 years or 3 years or 5 years and see what the economic consequences are, whether they're damaging or whether they won't be as bad. But I think it is a mistake to assume that Westminster can legislate for Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland and get away with it. If that were the case, okay, Dicey wins, but the devolution legislation would not be worth the paper it is written on. And it is a constitutional settlement in Scotland, and it's a constitutional settlement in Northern Ireland. And just to remind you of the complexity, the Northern Ireland Act is the legalized outcome of the Good Friday Agreement of 1998 that was negotiated by the United Kingdom, Northern Ireland, Ireland, overseen by the United States. It's an international document placed before the United Nations. The argument that Westminster could unilaterally pull the EU law from out of the Northern Ireland Act without the consent of any of the other parties is ludicrous. That's not how the United Kingdom has ever conducted politics, and just because it is technically possible to do so, it would be political madness to do so. It's technically possible to deploy troops to another country. Well, it would be political madness to do it without consulting Parliament. So the government wants to micromanage Brexit. I understand that. I think the way it is going about it, by using prerogative powers when it should be using Parliament, by going through Parliament when it should be consulting with the regional parliaments, it's not convincing. Thank you very much. Are you sure? Yeah.
You can turn your mic off, though, so listen to me instead of to your mumblings. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Kevin, for having me. Thanks all for coming. My task is to do the easy bit today, I think. So I think that UK's constitutional position seems to be even more complex than the EU's constitutional position surrounding the British exit of the EU. So what I'll do for the next 20 minutes or so is to run you through the type of constraints and a type of instruments that exist in EU law that will guide the process of negotiation under Article 50. So everything that Joe's talked about is only the start of this process. So EU law really comes in once Article 50 is triggered, however that will take place. So one of the things that very few people have picked up on so far is that the negotiation process and this sort of new deal that Theresa May seems to be working towards is actually two deals, two separate deals, and the difference between this is very important for the way these negotiations will be conducted. So one of the deals, and the straightforward one, is basically the separation deal. How do we separate from each other? So the kind of things that are negotiated there are things such as, you might have picked up on the press, sort of certain pension liabilities that Britain might have towards the EU, rumored to be about 50 or 60 billion pounds worth. The politically volatile one is, what do we do with EU citizens that reside in the UK? What do we do with UK citizens that reside in Europe? How do we deal with them? Do we give them a full right to residence? What do we do with their welfare entitlements? I'm Belgian. I have rights to welfare entitlements in the UK now under EU law. Will that still be the case after Brexit? These kind of things need to be negotiated in the separation settlements. Other things would be, what do we do with agencies that are currently operating from the UK? The European Banking Authority, European Medicines Agency are in London. What do we do with them? Who pays the lease? So there's endless amount of little detail that needs to be negotiated about how do we go apart, how do we pull apart. And no doubt, as soon as Article 50 is triggered, there'll be many more things that come out of the woodwork that we had never even thought about. For universities, for example, research funding. If we have a research fund that runs until 2022, what happens in 2019 when the UK leaves? Who pays for it? What happens to these legal obligations that have been created? So there'll be endless little details and more politically volatile things to do with citizen rights that will need to be discussed in this separation agreement. Now, I think it's difficult but not unfeasible to do that in 2 years. The rules on the EU side of things to complete the deal are that European Parliament has a say, and the decision by the member states, by the rest of the EU, is by what is called qualified majority, which means more or less that two-thirds of the state have to agree. So this seems that there's some leeway there to sort of negotiate a bit and a bit of potential on the UK side to actually negotiate, because knowing it doesn't need to have all EU states on board, but only two-thirds of state, more or less. The one problem, though, is that these negotiations on the separation agreements will be done by the Commission on the basis of a mandate by European Council. Now, European Council are the heads of state of the 27 member states that are left. So whether or not this separation deal will be very difficult to negotiate or not really depends on the specificity of the mandate of the European Council. Let's give an example. Say the Lithuanian president or prime minister says, in whatever the separation deal is, I want to guarantee that every Lithuanian citizen in the UK gets the right to residence and full right to welfare benefits. If the mandate from the European Council becomes so specific, the Commission can't negotiate anything but that, and the Council will very unlikely vote anything in favour of any deal that does not meet these kind of conditions. So the separation agreement, even though it's relatively limited in scope, can, I think, be negotiated in 2 years, but the freedom and the capacity of the UK to get something out of it will very much be constrained by the specificity of the mandate of the European Council. Now, that's the easy part. That's a politically relatively contained element. The complicated part comes when we talk about this new deal, the bold, ambitious new deal, new free trade agreement between the UK and the EU. And this will be incredibly complex to negotiate. I don't think there's ever been a free trade agreement with the EU that's been negotiated within 2 years, ever, let alone with a partner that's so close geographically and so important economically. And I think the complexities here are best explained if I take you on a little trip. So we start our trip in Singapore. And why in Singapore? Because one of the judgments currently going through at the European Court of Justice has to do with a trade agreement between Singapore and the EU. This trade agreement had been negotiated for, I think, 7 or 8 years, and ultimately signed by the Commission on the EU side and by the Singaporean government on the Singaporean side. Now, this was challenged before the ECJ by the member states, saying, look, the Commission, the European Commission, doesn't have power to do this. Simply the fact that the Commission signs it doesn't make it binding on all the member states. Why not? Because the free trade agreement involves certain areas, such as, I think it was IP and investment in transport and protection of trademarks, for which the European Commission doesn't have the exclusive competence. What does that mean? Quite a complicated term. It means that the member states have retained some power in these areas. The EU can do some things, economic and monetary union, competition policy. They have the exclusive competence to do that. Member states can't do anything in competition policy anymore. But in some areas, that competence is shared. So member states are allowed to do something, and the EU is allowed to do something else. So the argument there is that if you create a free trade agreement that comprises policy areas that are shared between the EU and the member states, such as in the Singaporean case, IP and transport, it requires not only the signature of the Commission from the EU side, but also the signature of every individual member state and every national parliament. So this is, if you remember, a few months ago that CETA, the Canadian Free Trade Agreement, was signed. And there was this last-minute hold-up because Wallonia, the Walloon Parliament, part of a Belgian state, refused to sign it. So the reality there is if not every member state and every sub-parliament, if in the member states trade deals are given to lower entities, if not everyone signs, something cannot enter into force. So you go from a situation in a Singaporean free trade agreement where it seems that the Commission is the one signing. As soon as the Commission signs, it applies. To a situation where the Commission has to sign, every member state has to agree, every national parliament has to agree, some federal parliaments have to agree within nation states, and in some member states, there's even a possibility of having a referendum on the outcome. So you go from a situation where you have one veto player, the UK negotiates with the Commission, to a situation where the UK has to negotiate with 27 different member states and their local parliaments and the Commission. So this puts potentially any new bold, ambitious deal makes it dramatically complex to agree on. Because the UK now is facing 28 veto players. If Malta says no, that's it. You can't have a free trade agreement. So the only way to circumvent this is to have a free trade agreement only covering areas of which the EU has exclusive competence, which is common commercial policy, which is customs union, which is economic and monetary policy, not that the UK wants to be in that. But already yesterday, listening to Theresa May, she indicated a few areas in which she would like to continue cooperation with the EU. She said, it's important to do police cooperation, to prevent terrorism, to jointly work towards that. It's important to have some sort of research agenda. It's important to work together in space exploration. It's important to have a border between Ireland and Northern Ireland, to think about that. It's important to facilitate the mutual recognition of judgments and of arrest warrants. It's important that all these kind of areas that they want to cooperate with the EU in, but all of these areas that I've just mentioned fall under the category of shared competence. So even if the UK would only want to solve the problem of not having a land border between Ireland and Northern Ireland, that needs to be done in a deal that allows every single parliament in the European Union to vote on it. So the Singapore story tells us, and this case is still ongoing in court, the Advocate General has said what I've just said, and more or less everyone in EU law agrees that was the very likely outcome of this case, is that as soon as you want to negotiate with a third country anything that is shared competence between member states and the EU, every member state has to sign off on it. So the lesson from Singapore, if you will, is that any bold, ambitious new trade deal puts the UK in a negotiating position against at least 28 other institutions that all have equal power. If one institution, if 51% of Maltese parliament says no, that's it, even if everyone else is on board. So that's one of the examples in which EU constitutional law, tells us that this free trade agreement is very complex to negotiate. Substantively, it's impossible already to negotiate in 2 years, let alone with all these constraints imposed by other actors that have a say on it. So that's the first stop in our little tour. The second stop is Switzerland. And why Switzerland? Because Switzerland is an example of how the EU deals with countries which it trades a lot, but are not member of the EU or member of the single market. So the situation, the deal between the EU and Switzerland is based on a number of bilaterals, which is slightly different from a free trade agreement, but not completely dissimilar. So what the Swiss experience tells us is that the main problem that the EU has when it comes to free trade agreements is that we need to have a mechanism to resolve disputes. So I'll use an example now that you might have heard in the context of TTIP, always a scare story of TTIP, where these chlorine chickens that would come into our market from the US. So in the US, apparently, routinely, chickens are cleaned with chlorine before they're marketed so that all viruses are out. In the EU, we think this is unhealthy to eat chickens that have been cleaned this way, so you cannot market them. So this is a typical problem when you have a free trade agreement. Say in the UK, I'm sure they won't do, but pretend in the UK, after Brexit, Westminster says it's fine to use chlorine in cleaning chickens and then market them. Under a free trade deal, it means that you can trade with the EU on reciprocal conditions. Say a UK company wants to sell these chickens in Germany, and Germany says, you can't sell them because it's against our rules. In Germany, it's not allowed, even though in England, it's allowed. Any free trade deal needs a mechanism to make sense of that. How do we deal with this? Can we sell this chicken in Germany or not? And why? So the European solution to that is to have a European Court of Justice. That clearly the UK doesn't want to. So in the Swiss bilaterals, they've come up with a new solution. And that new solution is we have what is called a guillotine clause. Sounds very dramatic. Which basically means that as soon as you violate the conditions that have been negotiated in free trade agreements, as soon as you stop free trade for a particular reason, as soon as you violate one part of the agreement, the whole agreement ceases to exist. And an example of how this happened in Switzerland has to do with free movement of persons. So Switzerland, one of the conditions under which we have this deal with between Switzerland and the UK and the EU, is that there's free movement for persons. So for all intents and purposes, Switzerland is part of the free movement area in the EU. Now last year there was a referendum in Switzerland being held, should we impose quotas on foreign workers? The Swiss population said, yes, we should, which gave the Swiss government a massive headache, because either it follows its referendum, says we have to impose quotas on free movement persons, but as soon as it does that, it offers the EU the opportunity to say, okay, everything's off the table. You have no more access, your goods can no longer access the European markets. So this guillotine clause imposes an incredible amount of discipline on the weaker partner in the negotiation process, because Switzerland would never use this. It doesn't make any sense for Switzerland to undermine this trade deal if the EU were not to follow a specific rule. So it's a very asymmetrical instrument for the enforcement. Now that doesn't sound very attractive for the UK anyways, and here's the good news. The Commission has already said, even before Brexit, that under no circumstances will it ever negotiate a new bilateral free trade deal that has these clauses, because they do not work well enough. It's a nuclear option, it's not an option to solve practical disputes on a case-by-case basis. So the Commission, against already before Brexit, has said any deal with a third country, there will have to be an enforcement mechanism that is a judicial enforcement mechanism. We need to have a mechanism that's not political, a judicial instrument that makes sense of these questions. Can we sell the chicken or not? Now, to further complicate the story, under EU law, this is for the EU lawyers, and I see quite a few students in the room, this is opinion 213 of the European Court of Justice, it has said that the autonomy of the European legal order cannot allow any institution other than the European Court of Justice to interpret the rules of EU law. Which basically means that it is illegal under EU law to have a judicial institution other than the European Court of Justice itself govern any deal with a third country. It is allowed to create a new judicial institution as long as it's controlled by the European Court of Justice. So what Switzerland tells us, what this example tells us, is that even if we were to come to an agreement between the UK and these 28 other member states, if every national parliament agrees to this, including the Walloon Parliament, everyone signs off on this, then it still will come with an enforcement mechanism that is, at the very least, supervised by the European Court of Justice. Again, something that was clearly a red line in Theresa May's speech yesterday. So this further complicates the story on this new free trade deal. The third part of our journey moves from Switzerland to the Netherlands, and I could have chosen any country, but the Netherlands was in the news most recently. And you might have spotted this at the beginning of this week. There was, in most media in the UK, it was reported that Lodewijk Asscher, who is the leader of the centre-left party in the Netherlands, they're currently in a coalition government, he said, under no circumstance will I sign off on a deal with the UK that doesn't prevent the UK from starting tax competition, from being basically the threat that Theresa May issued yesterday. If you don't give us a good deal, we'll compete with you on tax basis and try to undermine your structure by attracting capital and industry to come to our country. Asscher said, in any deal, there has to be a clause that stipulates you cannot do this. There is a minimum tax base, a minimum tax rate that you have to abide by, otherwise we won't do a deal with you. Now, the point isn't that he will do this. You'll probably be out of power in a few months anyways. The point I'm making is that as soon as you start negotiating a free trade deal with 28 member states, you are hostage to domestic political plays. Let's take an example. Let's say Alexis Tsipras says, I will only sign this free trade deal if Germany gives me a debt relief. Nothing to do with Britain, nothing to do with Brexit, but it's a power instrument as soon as you have to negotiate with 28 different actors. So the lesson from this is that, on the one hand, it is very difficult to control the substance of a free trade deal with 28 actors. So even though the substance of a deal will be about free trade, the political compromise that needs to be made won't necessarily be based on free trade. Secondly, between the period at which Article 50 starts and any free trade deal will have been agreed, there will be, in countless member states, there will be a new government. So how do you take that into account? How do you start from a position where governments might be aligned to a position where you have to vote on a free trade deal 5-6 years later, where in only 2 or 3 governments, countries, this government is still in power? How do we deal with that? And I suppose the lesson from all these 3 trips, from the Singapore story, the legal constraints, how to make a free trade deal, the Swiss example of how to institutionalize a mechanism for dispute resolution, and the Dutch story whereby national political interests all of a sudden become relevant for something that has nothing to do with national politics, really. The lesson from that, I suppose, is that any new free trade deal puts the UK at a very, structurally very weak negotiation position. It might be that everything aligns brilliantly. It might be less so. The lesson is that, at the very least, it shows that the UK is much less able to control the scope and the negotiation of this process than the EU sides are. So these are, I think, the lessons that looking at, even not before we look at the substance of EU law, before we start disentangling the single market from free movement, from customs union, only the structure through which the EU makes sense of these kind of deals with third countries puts the UK at a difficult position, which is, of course, the very purpose of these rules. So it'll be very interesting times the next few years, but I think purely looking at the law suggests that the separation agreement can be done in 2 years. I don't see any particular problems in doing that. Even the politically volatile rights of third country rights of UK nationals in the EU, EU nationals in the UK, I think there's a lot of goodwill on both sides to make sure that it's arranged quite quickly. So that deal, I think, can be done in 2 years and is realistically. The free trade agreement is a completely separate deal. So even though they will be negotiated at the same time, even though most media will understand this to be part of a similar process, legally they're very different. And that part is a lot more difficult to negotiate. That part is a lot less controllable by politics in London. And that is, of course, where Theresa May's transitional agreement comes in, because she needs to somehow make sure that there is a continued adherence to a shared rule, whatever it is, between the UK and the EU until a new deal comes into play. Now, final note on that transitional deal. One thing that's clear is that any transitional deal will still be under the auspices of the European Court of Justice. The EU cannot sign up, legally cannot sign up to anything that does not entail that kind of judicial oversight. So that's all. It sounds very complex, but I'm sure these kind of discussions will start as soon as Article 50 is triggered and as soon as the complexities and the constraints that EU law imposes on these negotiations will become more visible. Thank you very much. I think we're moderating, Kevin, or do you want to? Yeah?
Thanks very much for that. That's been very informative. Any questions, comments? We'll take them here. There's a microphone. It's on.
Makes me nervous. Hello?
Yeah, it's on.
Hello? Is it? Oh.
Yes.
Well, thank you, professors. I really liked your talks. And I think so far we've covered Brexit in the context of the relationship between the UK and Europe. And the EU, and I think the focus has been on free movement and trade and the economic aspects. Now, I have many questions about Brexit because I'm very ignorant. But I think that this one really difficult question for me, and I hope you'll enlighten me, which is, what do you think will be the legal structure of the EU after Brexit? In the domestic context, because on the one hand, Brexit is Brexit. It means European law should cease to have legal effect in the UK. That's a technical interpretation of Brexit, and it means the ECA 1973 must be repealed, and that Westminster must gain full sovereignty again. But on the other hand, I think we should take into account the legal effect of all European directives and regulations since the ECA. I think we should think about the economic policies and legal policy, acts of parliaments that are made in light of European directives and regulations. We should also think about our court rulings by the UK Supreme Court that are based in these directives and regulations and the ECHR. So how do we reconcile the things that have happened and the things that we want to do now in light of what will happen in the future? And particularly, it has been suggested that the Hong Kong model would be a good alternative. And I want to just briefly mention, for 100 years, Hong Kong had been a British colony. We followed UK law, the common law, and the Privy Council was our highest court. And in 1997, sovereignty was handed over from UK to China. We have our own basic law. China is the ultimate sovereign. And the basic law, Article 8, said that Hong Kong would keep all the existing laws until the date of the handover. So all the common law rules would continue to apply, except those which are in conflict with some PRC laws. So do you think that this Hong Kong model, that we keep most of the European-inspired laws, in the UK for now, it's a possible solution or outcome of our negotiations.
Okay. I think it's one for Joe.
I thought it was one for you. look, let me see if I can answer this. There's a lot in your question, and I'm not an expert on Hong Kong law. I might not be doing your question justice. But there is another irony, right, when it comes to this great repeal bill. The great repeal bill sounds great because you think, finally, we get the chance to repeal all these obnoxious European laws that have been bothering us for four decades. But then you read the small print, and this bill doesn't exist yet, but if and when it happens, what it will do is incorporate 40 years worth of European Union law into national law. And it's a process of incorporation which has never happened before. I don't know of any other in the history of law worldwide, I don't know another case where such a massive body of law has been transplanted, effectively incorporated into domestic law. It's unprecedented. And the consequences of that are unknown, right? Because we'd be incorporating all the case law as well, and that would suddenly become part of our common law. It would have a tremendous impact on the domestic legal system. So in our attempt to leave the EU, we are actually becoming the most Europeanized legal system on the planet. And I think there is an element here for Floris to answer, because it seems to me that, yeah, you can scrap the ECA tomorrow, right? But if you want to continue to trade with the European Union, then you have to match European safety standards. South Korea conforms to the single market regulations because it wants to sell its products here. And it's the European Union that says, well, these are the safety specifications. If you meet them, you can sell them. If you don't, you can't. Yeah? It's simple. So all this huge sovereignty issue is, I think, also part of myth-making, right? The practical answer is, do you want to trade with them? Then they set the rules. And if you want to leave, then leave. But I don't know why or whose idea it was to incorporate all this EU law. I mean, that is going to have, just to give one small example, for the public lawyers, this is a special one for you in the room. The doctrine of proportionality. It's a German thing. It's a German thing that has come to Britain via Strasbourg via Luxembourg. And now we sort of think, oh yeah, well, this is, the courts love it because it empowers the courts. It gives them another tool in judicial review cases beyond Wensbury to review government decisions. And it's a more rigorous test than Wensbury. And so they like it in the context of EU law and in the context of human rights law. We have not yet seen a case of purely domestic law where the courts have used proportionality. But presumably, when it becomes part of domestic law as a result of the Great Repeal Bill, the courts will have... it's a massive extension of court powers, thanks to the government, that actually, you know, keeps talking about limiting judicial powers. So none of this is thought through. So the Hong Kong model, yeah, maybe by default, but not by design.
And just to add something to that, I suppose the purpose of the Great Repeal Bill would be to prevent this sort of cliff edge. So the idea that you incorporate all EU law in national law means that you can still trade with each other, which, because UK companies still produce goods on a standards that are acceptable in the EU. So on day one, this might work, because on day one, all rules are the same. If on day two, the EU changes a directive on the production of bottles of water, then the only thing for the UK to do, if the purpose is to continue trade, is to copy this, to continue to copy EU law, to copy-paste it into national law, which is actually what many countries around the world do. UK Facebook, globally, follows EU regulatory standards, not because it has to in Argentina or in Azerbaijan or in America, but because it needs to, it wants to access the EU market, so it keeps up with that regulatory standard, even if it's not forced to in other countries. So on day one, this might work, but it requires a continuous updating of your own legislation in accordance with EU legislation. But that's not a real problem. The real problem of the Great Repeal Bill, and it's not a legal problem, is that the Great Repeal Bill might mean that you produce your goods in accordance to standards under which you can sell something in the EU, but as soon as the UK leaves the EU, it is a third state, and it cannot sell its goods in the EU without paying a certain custom duty. It's as if something produced in Azerbaijan is produced according to standards of the EU, doesn't mean it can freely sell it in the EU. It still needs to be able to access that market, and that access is provided either through free trade agreements or through paying customs duties. So on the first day, this Great Repeal Bill might seem that it actually streamlines economic cooperation, which it does in the manufacturing of these products, but it doesn't give access to the single market for UK producers.
Good. Other comments, questions, please, lady here. Could you just wait for the microphone so it can be recorded?
So Theresa May said yesterday that the final deal would pass through the Parliament, and she stated that it will be after how the government would negotiate the deal. So what is your view? What are your views on this way of passing the decision through the Parliament?
Well, Joe can discuss the UK implications, but I think in every single democracy in the world, international agreements have to be passed by parliaments. So this is not something particularly dramatic, I think, from general legal and constitutional law.
You were saying that Athens, Riga, Lisbon parliaments, they will all be voting on the UK deal.
Yeah, absolutely. Every single, in any free trade deal, except very limited to common commercial policy, will have to be voted by every national parliament in the EU and the UK.
I think the interesting issue is, not to put too fine a point on it, is the position of the Labour Party. Officially a pro-European party, but now the mood music from the Labour Party seems to be, we're not going to block Article 50, and we're not going to vote this deal down in Parliament. But in comparison, the Liberal Democrats are saying something different. The Liberal Democrats are saying we will block Article 50 and we will not support... we will not vote and support the government when it comes to this deal. So there are political alternatives. It's interesting that these political alternatives, for whatever reason, aren't being explored to the full right now. It seems that Theresa May has not been given a hard time over this politically. But I think that could change. Let's just wait until we see the deal. That's minimum 2 years, but probably more. Let's just see what that deal looks like. Let's see what the economy looks like by then. Let's see what Nissan has decided by then. let's see how what the political and constitutional, let's see what Northern Ireland has had to say by then. A lot can happen in 2 years. I think we saw that the mood changed after the divisional court's decision in the Gina Miller case. I think the mood might change again next week when the UK Supreme Court rules. I think the mood can change one way or the other, right? Several points in time for the next 2 years, so I think that's a long way off. It'll be interesting to see how the political parties stabilize and how they feel about the deal at the end. Ultimately, it boils down to politics. When there's political will, you can do whatever you want. But without political will, you've got the Prime Minister has a big hurdle.
As a political scientist, let me simply pause there and say that our legal friends are saying it's ultimately politics rather than law. So that's much cherished. Thank you. Could we take the lady here, please? Perhaps can we take a group of them?
Of course.
Thanks. I was wondering if you could comment on the Irish case. I've heard that there is a case pending before the Irish courts as well. Instigated by Julian Mom.
Yeah, yeah.
And it has a rather sophisticated argument regarding the possibility that Article 50 might have already been triggered and therefore the process has been unlawfully conducted so far. And if it hasn't been triggered, then the UK has been unlawfully excluded out of negotiations. And it's a little bit complex, and I was wondering if you knew more about it and if you could explain how it works and what the goal ultimately is of this of this litigation.
Let's take a few questions.
Yeah, sure.
So can we take the three on your right there, please, Danielle?
I just want to ask, if the Parliament does decide to vote against Brexit, what would it be a really serious constitutional consequence for a Parliament to disregard a referendum, because that has never happened before?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
In light of the impact that you said Brexit's had on the north of Ireland, what would you say the likelihood is of a border poll being held at some point in the near future?
Thank you for being here. My question would be, the EU has currently free trade agreements with over 50 countries all around the world. What will be of these trade agreements? Like, the UK should replace them? Or, and my second question will be, is there how many public servants does the UK need in this very moment? Because I guess in this moment they are focusing right now on the forthcoming negotiations with the EU. So what about all the other free trade deals? Thank you.
Thanks. Take those.
Yeah.
There's quite a lot.
I'll start off.
Okay.
I don't have much to say, really. Well, Vera, to your point about the Irish case, so I know there's another, I think this might be a separate Irish case, which basically the clear intention is to get the question to the European Court of Justice whether or not Article 50 is revocable or not. And I don't think that question will make it to the European Court of Justice because there's simply no standing for the party. There's no reason why the Irish applicants have a cause or have a reason to ask it to the ECJ. It's purely hypothetical, which kind of questions the ECJ normally doesn't take.
But presumably a UK petition Davina Miller could go there.
Yeah, it could. The Supreme Court could have referred the question that's currently pondering to the ECJ. Some people claim it should have done so under EU law. I mean, it wouldn't have made particularly much sense, but they could have done so. But the question itself, the substance of revocability, I think is relatively straightforward. I don't think there's many people arguing that it's not revocable. Everyone, both on the international and EU law, accept that you can revoke Article 50. So Theresa May, after year one, day 364, can simply say, we take it back. Now, that would not leave much, it might not make sense to do that politically, but legally speaking, it is a possibility. And then would mean that the UK still finds itself in the situation that it currently finds itself in, simply adhering to EU law in the sense and in the ways and the constraints it currently has. As to the FTAs that the EU currently has with countries around the world and what the UK's position would be, it depends on the type of FTA that exists. So some FTAs are signed by, as I said, every member state individually plus the EU plus, say, Switzerland. The bilaterals are all member states and Switzerland and the EU. And those would continue to exist even if the UK were to leave the EU. But some free trade deals are signed by the Commission only, because it only follows EU competences, and the UK would have to renegotiate those. They would automatically fall out of those. Now, the added complication is that under EU law, the UK is not allowed to negotiate any free trade deal until it has left the customs union. So even a new deal with Trump, say, cannot be negotiated until the EU leaves the customs union, which will be at the moment Brexit takes place. And if there's a transitional deal, only after a transitional deal. So it's even further complicated. Now, that doesn't mean in reality that they won't negotiate these deals beforehand, but they cannot sign or enter into force until the UK has left the EU completely.
It's interesting on the Article 50 question how that formed the meat of the Gina Miller decision in the Divisional Court, right? The case was lost because the government said that Article 50 was irrevocable, and because it was irrevocable, all these consequences followed. When it came to appeal, UKSC, they barely mentioned Article 50. That was simply no longer part of the government strategy to claim that it was revocable or irrevocable. It didn't form the meat of the decision anymore, so you could see that the government was backing down from that. Will there be a constitutional crisis if the referendum result is not respected? Was that the question?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, let me make 3 points and hear me out. No, I don't think it'll be a constitutional crisis because there is no constitutional provision in this country for legally binding referendums. Referendums cannot be legally binding because Parliament is sovereign. That's why they're advisory. In other words, it's a very expensive and hugely glorified and exaggerated opinion poll. That is, of an advisory nature on the government, but it is certainly not legally binding. So I think one has to question the political effort that is currently being invested to turn an advisory referendum into law. Would there be a political crisis? Yes, that argument I could see. That argument I do understand, that there's a political crisis in not respecting the opinion of a majority. But I don't think that's an insurmountable political crisis. Just to put the question back to you, and that's my third point on this, I do, however, think that there's a there is a constitutional as well as a political crisis if the result of the referendum means that Scotland is taken out of the EU against its will and Northern Ireland is taken out of the EU against its will. The question assumes that the natural majority that the English have is binding on the regions, and sitting in London, that might be easy to accept, but if you're sitting in Edinburgh or Cardiff or Belfast or beyond, that argument is unpalatable. After 20 years of devolution, simply is not going to wash, whether it's constitutionally accurate or not. So whichever way you turn, whatever the government does, there will be a crisis. The question for Theresa May is, what kind of a crisis would you like to have? Border poll in Northern Ireland, I don't know. I don't like making predictions about stuff that we don't know. The day after the referendum, Sinn Féin were talking up a border poll in the same way that Nicola Sturgeon was talking up IndyRef 2. Whether this will actually happen or not, I don't know. I can tell you something. If I was the Prime Minister, I would not want to be involved in any policy that stokes up a border poll in Northern Ireland, that in any way adds fuel to the fire of IndyRef 2. As a member of a unionist party like the Conservative Party, my overriding goal would be to keep the United Kingdom together in the long run. We know it is a fragile union. Brexit is revealing the fragility of the United Kingdom. Nothing that the government is trying to do right now is in aid of securing the longevity of the United Kingdom. If I was a unionist, I'd be deeply worried about the impact of the Conservative government's policies on the longevity of the United Kingdom.
Thanks for that. Joe, could I just follow up and say, that does the Scottish government have the power to call a referendum itself?
We don't know that. In 2014, the question was avoided because of the Edinburgh Agreement between Cameron and Alex Salmond, so by which power was passed, I think it's under Article 30 of the Scotland Act, I can't remember, from Westminster to Edinburgh, so power was delegated for them. But could this Scottish power hold an advisory referendum on whether it wants to be independent or not? Show me the provision that it can't. It would be an advisory referendum. It can hold an advisory referendum on any question it wants. It's an autonomous parliament. Is it binding? No. But the Scottish referendum wasn't constitutionally binding. It was just that David Cameron is on record, as every British Prime Minister has been since Margaret Thatcher, on record as saying, if the Scots vote to leave, we will respect it. It's politics, it's not law. Your field, not mine.
Thanks. Other questions? Can we take two, please, first here? Yes.
A question to both of you. A few months ago, I read a shocking comment by Ken Lennertz, the current president of the ECJ, who said on the Financial Times that Brexit may end up being decided by Luxembourg if the British court refers the matter to ECJ. So what's your view on that?
Okay.
Well, he would say that, wouldn't he?
And then David at the front here. David, you wanted to?
I'd like you to...
It's on.
It is on. Just go a bit further about this business about when you say, well, we don't know. It seems to me that the more you talk, both of you, the more we don't know. And it's, so, you know, if I were a continental lawyer, I mean, I'm not a lawyer at all, but if I were a continental lawyer, I would laugh and I would say, you see, this whole British thing about the unwritten constitution is ridiculous because they don't know. What would be the difference if we had a federal constitution so that it was quite clear whether you can leave or not the Federation and whether competence at the level of Scotland or Northern Ireland, presumably there it would be set out. It doesn't need to be in a normal state that isn't a sovereign state, that isn't a federal state. And surely, therefore, if it doesn't need to be, if the UK is a sovereign state, then it can do what it likes. There's a political problem, but there isn't a legal problem.
Yeah.
Okay.
I agree with that.
Any other last questions? You've had one. Any other questions? Fine. That's good. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, this is a political question. I was wondering if you think the British referendum would have been different if it was voted before the Scottish referendum.
Okay, thanks.
I'll take the question on Lena's on whether or not the ECJ will be the institution deciding on Brexit. The short answer is no, they won't. The European Court of Justice has the monopoly on the interpretation of EU law. So there's a few ways in which some elements of the Brexit deal might end up at Luxembourg, but they won't have the final say on them. One is... whether or not Article 50 is revocable or not. This is something that, unless this, the Irish case goes to the ECJ, at least won't come from the UK, or doesn't seem to come from the UK. And it doesn't mean that the ECJ decides on Brexit, it simply means that the ECJ decides on whether or not Theresa May can revoke Brexit afterwards. It doesn't say anything about the substance or scope of Brexit. So it's about interpreting the conditions under which Brexit takes place. The second way in which the court might be involved at some point is in an analogous case to the Singapore case, whether or not any new free trade deal between the UK and the EU touches on exclusive competence of the EU, where only the Commission signature suffices, or what is shared competence for which every member state needs to sign. Again, it doesn't decide on Brexit or not, it simply decides on the conditions under which any new deal have to be ratified according to EU law. And the third one, which is probably the most that would be considered interfering most by the European Court of Justice, if it says any new free trade deal that creates a new judicial institution that's not the ECJ or not overseen by the ECJ is illegal under EU law. Again, it wouldn't be directly deciding on Brexit. It decided exactly the same when the EU wanted to join the European Convention of Human Rights. It said it cannot do so because the European Court of Human Rights, rather, cannot be overseeing EU law above our own interpretation. So there's different ways in which the European Court of Justice could come in, but they're only very, very marginally connected to whether or not Brexit actually happens.
David's question, great question. And it is as comical as you suggest. So let's imagine, Article 50 says that any member state can leave the EU in accordance with its own constitutional requirements. Now, how generous is that on behalf of the EU? So it throws the ball back into our court, and we have to ask ourselves, what are our constitutional requirements? And embarrassingly, we don't know how to answer that question because we don't understand our own constitution. Is it the prerogative? Is it an act of parliament? Is it the prime minister? Is it a minister? I mean, is it parliament? We don't know because, precisely as you say, we don't have a written constitution. Although we do, of course, have a constitution, and we should be led by people in power who understand the constitution and who don't make it up as we go along. Academics can make it up as we go along. That's how we justify our title as professors of public law or whatever. But, you know, those in power should have a clearer understanding of what the constitution is. And so this whole case, this whole Brexit case now heard by the 11 justices in the Supreme Court is an answer, is an attempt to find the answer to the question, what are the constitutional requirements of the UK? And it's interesting that it's the EU that is asking the question and we are being forced to answer it. But on your conclusion that can't the UK do whatever it wants? Absolutely. And if the UK were a truly sovereign state, It wouldn't be bothering with Article 50. Article 50 is the EU's housekeeping measure of how you leave. But the UK could have left at any point in the last 40 years. The EU is a club, it's not a prison. At any point in time, it could have passed an act saying we are now leaving the EU and scrapping the ECA in 1972, and we're out. Thank you very much. All this trying to... why is a sovereign country like the UK trying to appease the Article 50 provision in the TEU? A truly sovereign country wouldn't have to do that. This suggests to me that it is according way more power to the European Union than it has to. I mean, it's nice of the UK. It's nice that it is playing by the rules, but it doesn't have to. It could leave tomorrow. Would the Wilson's question about the timing of the referendum... I have no evidence for this, for what I'm saying, so don't quote me on it. But I don't think an EU referendum could ever have been won. Not since the Maastricht Treaty, not since the BSE crisis of the late 90s. I've been in this country for 20 years. There's always been anti-European sentiment in Parliament, in the press, amongst people. No one loves the EU. You're not supposed to love the EU. But it's an easy object to trash. I don't think this referendum is winnable. I am actually surprised that 48% of the British people voted to remain. I think that's the huge surprise. Not that 52 wanted to leave. So, I don't think this referendum could have been won. I don't think this question should ever have been put in a... I don't think the question should ever have been put to the people in a referendum, but that's a different story.
Okay, I think we have more knowledge now about the unknowns, as it were, a kind of Donald Rumsfeld notion that we're much more informed about what we don't know than previously. But before I finish, can I just mention the upcoming lectures in this series covering the different aspects? Next week, we're going to be looking at Brexit and public opinion in the UK and in other European countries, the rise of Euroscepticism, different varieties of Euroscepticism. What is it that the public wants from Europe in the UK and other countries? And so please do join me for that. To repeat, you will be able to download the film of today's lecture, and you can pass that information to your friends and colleagues. But before we finish, please join me in thanking very much Joe Merkins and Floris de Ritter. Thank you.